on that one.
The Senate Human Services Committee and Early Childhood Committee will come to order. It's Thursday, February 19th. Welcome. Good news, we've been getting out of here early. Today we will not, because we have a lot of really good things to talk about. So we'll dive right in. We're going to go in the order that we are listed here. So I'm going to open up an informational hearing on the Oregon Psychiatric Access Line About Kids, also known as OPAL-K. And I would invite up Dr. Ching and Dr. Pedersen.
Thank you very much. Dr. Pedersen unfortunately had an illness in the family and couldn't join us, so I'll be making more of the presentation.
Okay. We could be getting out early then, huh?
Perhaps.
Not nice try, Senator Olson. Not likely.
I feel good about making this presentation because I hope I have some good news for an investment that the legislature was generous enough to provide us and providing a new service to the medical homes of Oregon. So the OPAL-K mission statement is to expand the availability of timely, high-quality mental health treatment to youth in Oregon through the support of the medical home. And so as part of the triple aim that we've been trying to engage all the clinicians in Oregon to make use of, we feel like we're part of the solution to helping the triple aim grow in Oregon. A little history. The OPAL-K program grew out of a collaboration between pediatricians and child psychiatrists. We share the same population. Back in 2006, when Dave Willis was the president of the Oregon Pediatric Society, he engaged a group to form a mental health task force. And out of that task force grew this project. But with the project, we would have never got off the ground without the support from you all in the legislature by you in authorizing investments in child mental health, including a pilot funding for OPAL-K. And in a very short period of time, when we had our contract in hand in January, we were able to staff our program, develop our workflow, get our offices, get the equipment all set up to set up our program. And started taking calls just recently in June last year. Again, it's more than a collaboration with Oregon Pediatric Society and the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. It's also a collaboration with OHSU Dornbecker Children's Hospital, who helped us provide the infrastructure, and also with the Oregon Health Authority. So the goals of OPAL-K were to improve child psychiatry access for primary care providers and create opportunities for mentoring, education, and consultation. We also wanted to create a service that's blind to insurance, so whether you have private or public insurance, we wanted this program to be available to all youth of Oregon. We wanted to improve the access to children's mental health services in primary care, medical homes, and school-based programs and public health programs. And we'll see a little bit more about that in some later slides. Presently, what we're doing is we provide same-day psychiatric phone consultations to any primary care clinician who has a question about mental health care that they see in their practice. And so right now, if someone calls, they can get a hot transfer and talk to a child psychiatry with this phone consultation program. I think it's about 95% of the time. And what we try to use for education purposes during the consultation is evidence-based information. And to back us up, we also have devised these treatment guidelines, which include medication algorithms to help the primary care doctors and the pediatricians provide evidence-based treatment in their practices. We're just not about medications, however. We also talk about a biopsychosocial perspective to treatment. So a lot of times a child may be having a lot of problems, but it's just not about medications. Just by having a discussion and formulating the case, we may discover other ways of helping the child and their family be successful without just prescribing medication. So access to a higher quality level of treatment and providing a better experience for youth and children is our major goal.
And do you prefer to wait for questions till the end, or?
Sure, you can ask questions, I'm fine.
Okay, thank you. So when a pediatrician calls, are you is this designed primarily for more kind of chronic ongoing issues for a child, or are the child psychiatrists able to provide immediate intervention for a child that's in crisis, perhaps a child that's suicidal?
Well, the mission statement is for anything that comes into a primary care clinician's office. So they may have a child who comes in who's in acute crisis, and the consultation may result in advice to send to the emergency room, for example, if there's a worry about suicide. We've had a call about a unborn child with a mother who was using drugs at the time, and they were wondering how can we support the child before they were even born. We've had calls regarding people in the autistic youth in a hospital. So we're not trying to necessarily screen any calls out from a certain level of care, but the primary intention is to make the medical home work so that the primary care clinician can feel comfortable in seeing as many mental health issues in their practice without having to refer out to other clinicians or agencies.
Well, I guess just as a quick follow-up to that, I'm just interested in this because I live in a community that's been experiencing a pretty significant suicide cluster for young people, and the emergency room experience is really not helpful at all. Is this program able to provide resources or guidance to the emergency? I mean, even our local child psychiatrist says that the emergency room isn't following protocols for individuals. They'll give them a sleeping pill, send them home.
Well, our funding only provides for 9-to-5 staffing of the call line. So for an emergency room, you know, I would say a lot of their calls are outside of that time.
Okay.
So we've talked about whether we should aim for a program specifically targeting ER departments, but we haven't figured out a way of funding that to be available. But certainly if an ER physician calls, we're not going to not take the call. And like I said before, we took a call about a patient in a hospital setting, which is, again, not what our mission was, but we don't turn people away from calling us.
Thank you. Senator Montes-Anderson.
Thank you, Dr. Chang, for being here. I, of course, would like to expand this, but I do want to make the committee aware that we have a real crisis, and I think you're going to point that out. The rate of child psychiatrists in Oregon is pretty low, and I have gotten concerns from Central Oregon primarily. Robin Henderson at the, which hospital is it in Bend?
St. Charles.
Yeah, St. Charles. They've lost, what, 4 psychiatrists or psychologists, either one, and they had called Opal K, but because the patient was in the hospital, you couldn't help them. And those are the types of things that I think we need to look at on how we can expand access, and I'm not sure where you are regarding that, but there is a real need, not just now, as I'm finding out, with our primary care providers, which was the focus of this, but to maybe expand it. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, I want to address this example you give because I'm actually the doctor who took the call.
Okay.
The hospitalized autistic youth. And what I don't know how it got construed that we didn't want to be helpful, but what I put in it was this child was on 8 different medications, and they were asking advice about what other medication they may use. And what I demurred was, it's like this person's on 8 medications. It's hard for me over the phone to make suggestions, and that I thought they should have an inpatient stay to sort this all out. And so they took it to mean we couldn't help you at all. But in fact, in this specific case, because I also wear hats as the chief medical officer at Trillium, I found a bed there to create that child could have been admitted to. But that was turned down later because they decided they could get by without it. So I would say this is actually an example of Opal K meeting the need above and beyond our mission statement by actually providing a bed. So I don't know the extent of what was told to you, but that's the story from my point of view, from the doctor who actually took the call. So we actually made a bed available for them.
That's great. Well, what I would love to get from you is what more could we do? there is such a change in culture in this legislature to do more and more for mental health. And if somehow, since you're the gurus of and know the needs in the communities and in the state, what suggestions would you have that we could maybe focus our mental health dollars rather than just sending it to the county, sending it to elsewhere, I should say, that could help meet the needs of those that have mental problems?
We could skip to the slide that has that, but I don't know, maybe Senator Olson doesn't want to see all the data points to get out earlier.
We can get
Put them up there. Let's see them.
Okay, so let's race through the data points.
Okay, okay.
But I do want to answer your question specifically. Okay.
This is what happens when your committee is really excited about your information hearing.
So we know there's a shortage. We don't have to go through this slide. I just want to add that the doctor's average years of experience, I mean, it's 20 years, so the primary care doctors are speaking to very experienced clinicians, and I think it reflects in their experience will show that. Here's our website for those of you who are interested on OHSU's panel of websites. And I would just mention, if you ever get time, you can go look there. But the great thing about the website is a primary care clinician can register for the service online. They can also get mental health care guides online and download them. We've enrolled 813 clinicians. I think, and they're primarily family practice and pediatricians. I don't know the exact number. I'm guessing it's about 3,000 primary care clinicians if you include just the family practice and pediatricians together. So maybe we're 25% the way of getting everybody enrolled, but that's our goal, to enroll as many as possible. The other thing, the clinicians that are included are nurse practitioners, and they actually call quite often to get assistance. I have a slide to show you that we're actually developing relationships with those people. So here's where we did our outreach. And so if you can see from these little markers there, we've been heavily concentrating our outreach to rural communities or underserved communities. Dr. Pedersen, unfortunately, is not here, but we actually engaged her to actually take a tour of the coast and to Eastern Oregon, and where she actually went to FQHCs that, you know, are really undermanned in terms of mental health, and tell them about our service. And every time someone does outreach, we get more calls, which has been great. We also do outreach through our sister program START. So this is through the Oregon Pediatric Society's screening, treatment, and referral trainings. And I'm also a trainer for START. And this is their map for their START trainings for this coming year. The first year, they've already done as many of these trainings in other regions. I've given START trainings down in Medford, for example. And every time we do a training, we also promote each other's programs. So at all START trainings, we talk about Opal K as a resource. And at all Opal K programs, we talk about considering START to come to your practice to do some training. Probably what's interesting to people is about the call distributions. And so as you can see from these bars here, you know, most of them appear to come from the major metro areas. So Multnomah County, Clackamas County, and Washington County have the bulk of the calls. But you can also see Deschutes County has more calls than Clackamas County. So we're trying to help out in Central Oregon.
Did Benton County not call, or are the bees just not there?
I guess we didn't get that on the grid. We'll have to fix that.
Your county's okay.
See, the chair is from Benton County.
Well, I figure if you got that many from Deschutes, we probably. I mean, I also did outreach. I did a presentation at St. Charles, a START training and a presentation. So,
I'm
pretty sure.
Clinics as well.
Well, so we'll double check to see if they didn't include those together. It looks like we don't hit rural as much as urban, but actually, if you look at the numbers, per capita number of children, we actually have as many calls per capita from a rural site as we do urban. So we actually, you know, proportionally are taking more calls from the rural areas. Here's the thing about relationship building. The blue bars on the bottom here represent single calls, but all of the bars above, the red, green, purple, blue, orange, they represent people who call more than once. So the red bar is people who call twice, the green bar is three times, and so on and so forth. So we're actually developing working relationships with these people so they feel they can get a curbside consultation anytime they want. Again, here's the registered providers. Again, pretty similar to where the calls come from. Though, did we get Benton?
Mm-hmm.
13 people registered in Benton.
Thank you.
And then just for your own information, the diagnoses that we seem to be getting asked a lot about is depression, as one could guess, and concerns about the suicides, but also anxiety disorders and ADHD. And we get a fair number also here, PDD and ASD, that's the autism spectrum disorder kids. So we actually probably get maybe disproportionate number of calls on them because they're harder to manage. So the original pre-service survey was to ask, is there adequate access to child psychiatry for my patients? And of course, the majority of them said
no.
Am I able to, with existing resources, meet the needs? Better, but not quite. And am I able to concentrate? Am I able to consult with a child psychiatrist in a timely way? This is actually the same data that we got from. Let's see. We took that slide out. This is the same data that we got from the Massachusetts program. I mean, we used their template in asking the same questions, and they had similar results in the beginning. But basically, by the time the service was completed after a year, in their initial year, you know, 80% of the primary care clinicians queried said they were able to consult with a child psychiatrist in a timely manner, and we're hoping to replicate that. We do have post-service surveys right now that we have the clinicians, if they care to, fill out online. So about 43% of people who receive service actually bother to fill this out. So we feel pretty good that they think the service is worthwhile enough that they actually bother to fill out this post-service survey. And again, as you can see from there, most of them feel like the consults have been very useful. They feel like they got their consult in a timely manner. They were satisfied with the process, that they received assistance more quickly because of OPAL-K, and they increased their skills in mental health management on the last line. So again, if people are saying that they don't think we're very useful, I would just give them data and say the primary care clinicians feel like this is very useful. We're one of many agencies, so nationally there's many programs. I think there's about 30 programs now who are throughout the country who are starting up these kinds of access consultation programs, and we are one of the many growing. So you, Senator Anderson, you were asking about vision, you know, what can we do more than just phone calls? And so here are some of the things that we'd like to do to aid Central Oregon and other areas that are low on child psychiatrists, is to add face-to-face evaluations, and if we can't be there in person, to add telemedicine evaluations. And as we speak, we've set up appointments to meet with Dr. Peoples, who's the medical director at Central Oregon Pediatric Associates. It's a 20-plus primary care pediatric clinic, and we're going to pilot some telepsychiatry assessments in their office. So maybe it'll start as once a month. We'll have 4 hours for them to fill our schedule with, and as the program grows, maybe weekly we can provide at least psychiatric assessments to them to help guide them and aid them in providing care in the medical home. We're also on the last bullet. We're working with the ECHO program approach. I just spoke to Mark Lovegren from our telehealth program at OHSU about being involved in providing an ECHO type of project. ECHO was initially created in New Mexico to provide primary care clinicians the expertise to take care of hepatitis C patients in their own practices. And hepatitis C is a pretty complicated, you know, viral illness that affects the whole body. And so the average family practice doc or nurse practitioner felt very unsure of providing care. But with the help of an ECHO program, which is a group of consultants who have weekly connections and conversations and consultations and case presentations in New Mexico, they've been able to radically decrease the cost of taking care of hepatitis C patients. And so in Oregon, we're trying to replicate that ECHO process in different types of programs. And most recently, we're looking at child psychiatry as being part of that. Another program they're starting up at OHSU is with children with diabetes and endocrine problems, as an example. So that's another program about whether or not you want to fund something that have an ECHO project for Central Oregon, for example, that can help improve some access or at least improve the skills of the clinicians there to provide service. So I think that's my last slide. Oh, actually, I guess there's more slides. So in conclusion, what we think OPAL-K is doing is really supporting the triple aim. We get better patient experience because they don't have to wait so long. We can save money by not waiting for the care to start. And we can also improve the health of these youth by intervening earlier. We can actually save money by improving prescribing practices. I've taken calls where someone's been given 8 medications at one time or 7, and after a discussion, we can talk about, you know, cutting down the number of medications, improving the health of the child by not having complications of over-medications, but also saving cost. Our algorithms actually look at cost in medications. Why use a non-generic medication that costs 10 times more than a generic that has the same efficacy and the side effect profile? So that's part of what we're trying to do. And then promoting a comprehensive approach. Frequently what happens, particularly in cases where there's over-medication, people are just trying to medicate a psychosocial issue that's going on. If there is abuse going on in the family or there's other problems with bullying at school, you can give all the medication you want to that and that child's not going to get better. But if you help the clinicians see in a broader way of just not prescribing medications for troubled behavior, but thinking in a larger way about what other problems could be going about, you can help also improve the health of these kids and cut down on the number of medications. Any other questions?
Doctor, you have one more slide?
I do have one more slide. Additional potential services. So again, we talked about telemedicine and then consultations to teams and mental health clinics. So that's the ECHO project there. We've also had contact with Oregon Youth Authority, looking at can we help them with their population. We're talking about consultation with them. Another program we've talked to with is various CCOs have interest in OPAL-K doctors reviewing cases of polypharmacy that come up on their screen using the foster care criteria. So if a child's on double antipsychotic or double antidepressant, if they're being medicated at an age less than 6, if they've got medications that are being used without FDA approval, those kinds of things are kind of like a red flag that a consultation would be very helpful for that practice.
Well, thank you so much. Are there
one
questions?
I know we need to move on, but what about reimbursement now? Are you able to bill for your consultations through the, you know, we're developing, we're going to pass out, I swear, it's in my committee, a telemedicine bill. So we're moving that way, and I'm very cognizant of the fact that we need to start thinking about reimbursement, and I was just wondering.
So as an example, there's a CCO that we've been in discussion with, Dr. Jetmalani and I have met with, who are talking about that very thing, about setting up a contract. So if we're going to review cases for your CCO, what will that be looking at? So we are looking at sustainability issues past the granting phase.
Great. Thank you. And if I could just come back to our questions before, I think Senator Montes Anderson and I were kind of swooping out to some of the bigger issues that we have around access to child psychiatry. I know Kids in Crisis can have a months-long wait to get in. But if I understand the goal of this program, it would be to better equip primary care physicians to handle the less intensive needs that they could manage in the primary care practice. And if we were able to do that, we might free up some of the capacity with child psychiatrists in local areas to have that ongoing face-to-face, day-to-day, direct
less
management.
Crises to have to manage, too.
Right.
Maybe less ER visits as a result of that.
Great. Senator Olson.
This is purely my naivete on this issue. You deal with children less than 6 years old?
Yes, constantly.
Really?
I'll give you the biggest population that primary care has to deal with is the youth with autism. One of the START projects was to identify kids with autism, so the goal of the Oregon Pediatric Society through their START training was to have all children in Oregon screened for autism before the age of two using a screening instrument called the MCHAT. And so, you know, it used to be autism spectrum disorders were thought to be 1 in 150. Well, the latest figure I heard was 1 in 68. So whether or not we have more because of a variety of reasons, whether it's pollution or genetics or, you know, having babies later in life, it seems like the experts are thinking that there are more youth with this problem. And that would be an example of a burgeoning population that needs mental health consultation.
So those children that are less than 6 years old, what is the largest category of?
It would be autism spectrum disorder. Right. And usually you get calls about kids who are like hitting themselves or headbanging, and you know, what do I do to take care of this child who's always coming into my office, you know, with lacerations, and the parents don't know how to manage this.
Typically, I would have thought that the headbanging would have been we senators at our age. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Right.
We really appreciate it. Thank
you. That was yesterday.
And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Opal K, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 114. Senator Dimbrough, do you want to go to the dais?
I'll just do it from here, if that's okay, Madam Chair. So I'm very happy to bring Senate Bill 114 to you. Before I begin, is there anybody here from Oregon State who's part of that program? We're having a presentation on it, actually, this evening here in the Capitol, and so I had hoped to bring the two into alignment, but wasn't able to, apparently. So let me tell you something about it. Actually, the bill itself kind of explains what two-generation strategy is, but this is something that I discovered in my current capacity as an NCSL, National Council of State Legislatures, fellow on early learning. There are three of us who are fellows this year. I'm the only fellow who's a fellow. The other two are Reps Vega Peterson and Springer. And last year, the first year they had this, the fellow was Representative Lively. And they bring people together, expose us to different kinds of programs, both in person and through webinars, and ask us to do readings, et cetera, on cutting-edge issues related to early learning. And one of the programs that is really getting the most attention right now within early learning circles is what's called a two-generation strategy, which is an effort to break the cycle of poverty, you know, multi-generation cycles of poverty, by simultaneously providing education to the children and to the parents, right? So you have children who are enrolled in high-quality pre-K programs while the parents are also enrolled in community college or university pursuing high-value certificates or degrees. And the programs that have been real models on this are private-public partnerships, which not only provide those educational programs, but also provide supportive housing environments for single parents. We visited one of these in Minneapolis during the summer. It was called the Jeremiah Program. And I'll send you all information about this. I thought that was done, but I will. Which is really having some remarkable results by providing housing that's affordable while having, you know, really high-quality pre-K right there in the housing area. And then students are going to, the parents are going to the local community college or to the University of Minnesota. And there is also a lot of life coaching involved in it, mentorship, you know, financial literacy, all those things that can create success for the parents while, you know, also, you know, they feel comfortable and confident that their kids are getting really good education. And they themselves, I think, generally actually work in the or somehow have a presence in the pre-K program, so they're learning good parenting skills as well. Anyway, the NCSL Early Learning Department has been encouraging legislators to spread the word on these programs to our colleagues and to encourage our education departments to look into them. And so that's where this bill is coming from. And what it's doing is it's directing the Oregon Education Investment Board, the OEIB, which, of course, is, you know, works on the full gamut of education from, you know, pre-K through university, to look into fostering such a program here in Oregon. You know, studying the viability of it and perhaps, you know, if appropriate, designing a pilot project and then reporting back to us in time for, you know, potential action for the 2017 session. So that's in a nutshell what this bill does. Colleagues, as I mentioned, there's going to be a presentation on it actually from 5:30 to 7, I think, with some food down in room 50 this evening that should be really very interesting. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions about this.
And we also have Peter Tromba here from OEIB to talk about the bill as well.
Great. Okay. Yeah.
Are there questions for Senator Dimbrough before we bring Peter up?
No? That would be great.
All right. Yeah. Peter, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Tromba, and I'm the Research and Policy Director for Oregon Education Investment Board. I just have a few words to say about this proposed legislation. First off, in doing a crash course in research on this exact topic, I've been really happy to see and hear you cite a number of the elements that provide evidence that this is a great approach. One part of that is a two-generational approach. It seems like a slap your head when you see it. Makes perfect sense, but I don't think it was necessarily made sense before people articulated that it's not something that you can just work with individual students. It really needs to break a cycle and work with a family. In doing research on what are the elements of a two-generational approach, I was really happy to see that in the proposed legislation, all the key elements that research suggests are there are in the bill. Specifically, focus on programs, policies, systems, and research. And the research component is something that I think is really smart to look at how we might pilot this rather than just launching into a particular program. Let me just I want to mention one other thing about a two-generational approach that I think will resonate with folks. If you are approaching both children and their parents at the same time, there's a mutual motivation factor between both of those groups. So imagine the household, and the mom or the dad is receiving education at the same time the child is getting education. That tends to produce an environment where there's self-reinforcing behavior, self-reinforcing discussions about the value of it. And OEIB, honestly, is uniquely positioned to be able to do this work. For one thing, we do supervise and coordinate the work of early learning, higher ed, and K through 12, and that would be required for any such pilot or more extensive program. But also, and I'm not sure the committee members are aware of this, we have a research team at OEIB. It's a small one, but it's a strong one. And one of the most important strengths of our team is the way we look at research with respect to whether we're looking at programs or people, whether we're looking at assets or deficits. And in particular, when you look at programs as the answer, and when you look at needs as the answer, you get programs. Whereas you look at assets as the answer, you get people that end up supplying the answers to the problems. And when you look at deficits, you end up with getting a very, very different program than when you look at assets. And for folks who are going to be the beneficiaries of this program, we can either do this with communities or to communities. And the way that we do research is looking at ways that we can involve the folks who are going to be beneficial of it at the get-go so that the kind of research that we produce really is something that's owned by everybody involved. What I'd finally like to say is we'd appreciate the opportunity to work with the sponsor of this bill to understand and maybe refine the scope of the research in the pilot just so we can understand it better and make sure it gets done by the date. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Beth.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 114? Seeing none, thanks so much for bringing this to our attention. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 114 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 503. And I'm wondering if we can have Cheyenne give a brief overview, and then Senator Montes Anderson, do you want to go down or stay up?
Let's stay here.
Okay. Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 503 requires the Department of Human Services to identify sexual assault victims and persons at risk of becoming victims among TANF applicants, that's Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and recipients, that is applicants or recipients, and includes specified information and a report to the legislature every odd number of years.
Thank you. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and what I am hoping that we will do is pass this out. We need to close the gap in emergency assistance for sexual assault and domestic violence survivors. And survivors of sexual assault are not eligible for this life-saving assistance, but they should be. And the amount of allowable assistance now covers fewer emergency needs, up to $1,200. And I think this was set in 1996. So increasing that allowable allowance would be extremely helpful. I think that Sybil Hebb, isn't she?
Yeah.
Will be able to go into a lot more detail than I. But domestic violence we're in a crisis in Oregon with domestic violence, and I think that this legislature, our goal, our task, our mission should be to take care of our most vulnerable, and for sure, domestic violence victims are some of our most vulnerable in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have 5 folks. I think I'm going to bring up Sybil Hebb and Michelle Roland Schwartz first, and then I'll bring up the Centra folks together as a panel in a minute. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and here today in support of Senate Bill 503. We very much appreciate the committee's giving us our time to talk about this issue and the support that you have all shown for survivors in your work. And as you know, I work for the Oregon Law Center, which provides civil legal assistance to low-income people. And a significant majority of our clients are a growing category of our clients are people who are survivors of domestic or sexual violence who are struggling because of the trap that is created by abuse and violence that's been perpetrated against them. And sometimes that gives rise to legal assistance issues that we can help them with, but very often and significantly it gives rise to major safety concerns that can't be resolved without financial assistance. And those clients really deeply rely on the assistance of the Department of Human Services and organizations like the ones that Michelle and the others from the domestic and sexual violence programs behind me will talk about. So the Temporary Assistance to Domestic Violence Survivors Program was created in 1996 by advocates working to provide a way for the agency to provide immediate critical emergency assistance in that time of crisis when a survivor who is low income and who has minor kids needs some help in order to get to a safe place. So, for example, somebody might have suffered an assault and need a lock change in order to secure the home, and that lock change is something that because of their low income and their lack of other resources, they couldn't pay for by themselves. And the agency is able to step in and provide that assistance in a way that resolves that safety need, which provides immediate physical safety, but also helps to prevent the future trauma that is suffered if there is perpetrated abuse in the future. And we know that domestic and sexual violence have such a huge impact on people's physical health, but also on their psychological and mental health moving forward, and has great long-lasting impact. So anything that we can do to prevent that crisis is really beneficial in the immediate as well as the longer term. So the way the program works is a caseworker at the Department of Human Services is authorized to work with a survivor to come up with a safety plan to say, what are the immediate critical safety needs that you have, and is there a way that we can satisfy those? And they're eligible for payments up to $1,200, which is the cap that was created in 1996. Those payments don't go to the individual. They go to the locksmith, for example, or to buy a bus ticket from the bus ticket provider if transportation, for example, is necessary to get a family out of an emergency situation and to their mother's house across the state or something like that. And so the program has an incredible benefit in that it's flexible and efficient. It provides immediate assistance to people who are very vulnerable. And the other thing that is really wonderful about it from our perspective working with our clients is that it attaches to an analysis of safety planning and safety needs. And it's a way to help survivors get connected to other resources in the community, like the victims' advocates that work at the nonprofit shelters, like the legal system, like other places that they may not otherwise have known about or had access to. And so we view it as a small way to have a really large benefit for families. And the two gaps that exist right now are that the way the eligibility is identified in the statute, only certain domestic violence and sexual assault survivors are covered. In order to be eligible, you have to have had a perpetrator who was a family or household member. And so if you happen to have been sexually assaulted by a person who was a neighbor, for example, or a coworker or a stranger, you're not eligible for those same benefits, and yet you have those same needs if you're low income and you have minor children and you're in danger. So we want to make sure just to resolve that technical glitch in the definition so that sexual assault survivors are eligible. And then, as Senator Monta Sanderson, thank you, mentioned, the cap on the benefit used to be enough, really, to help someone pay for moving costs and maybe first month's rent or a deposit so that you could get into a safe place where you didn't have to face going home to an abusive situation. And just given the cost of living and the extreme housing pressures that our communities are suffering from, it's just no longer enough to satisfy that need. So the bill as drafted would increase the cap to $2,000. That doesn't mean that everybody gets $2,000. It's just that's the amount up to which a payment could be made if, in the judgment of the caseworker and the survivor, there are benefits or are needs that reach that amount. And then there would be a CPI adjuster attached to that so that it would, in the future, be more responsive and able to fulfill its original purpose. I would just point out otherwise that there is written testimony from Children First for Oregon that should be on the record, and we appreciate their support in recognizing that this is an important benefit for minor children as well. And so we really thank you for your time.
And Sybil and Senator Monta Sanderson, is the bill good to go in its current format?
Very good.
Welcome. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Michelle Roland-Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. The task force is a statewide nonprofit, and our purpose, our mission, is to improve the response to adult and adolescent sexual assault in Oregon through multidisciplinary response, looking at prevention and improvement of response across the state. Our task force is comprised of over 100 members that represent their respective fields, and that includes victim advocates, law enforcement, and criminal justice practitioners, violence prevention educators, medical professionals, policymakers, youth, and survivors of sexual assault. Happy to be here today in support of Senate Bill 503 to close the gap in emergency assistance coverage to sexual assault victims. This bill was a very easy one for the task force to get behind. We know that victims of sexual assault immediately following the sexual assault are faced with many decisions and needing to get access to resources, including legal, medical, and support services, ensuring that they are better able to navigate their options is a critical piece in ensuring that they have access to options for legal, medical, and support systems. And if we have safety measures put in place, we know that they're better able to access those resources, increasing their likelihood that they'll seek other critical services to address their needs. Access to emergency transportation, shelter, security locks, lock changes, and other emergency expenses increase their safety and provide victims with a strong foundation for healing. We know that sexual assault often occurs near victims' homes or in their homes, and the homes of friends, family, or acquaintances. And perpetrators are often known to survivors, whether they be intimate or non-intimate partners. As a result, home may not be a safe place. Barriers to emergency safety provisions only serves to compound the emotional trauma experienced by victims, a consequence we have the opportunity to prevent if we close the gap in emergency assistance to sexual assault victims. We believe that Senate Bill 503 will extend an important remedy to victims of sexual assault, positively impacting their immediate and long-term safety. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill, and please let me know if you have any further questions.
Thank you both very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Seeing none, I guess you answered it all in the presentation. Thank you both very much. And next we have Letitia Wilson, Christina McGovney, and Jane Downing.
Ready?
Welcome. And so, if you haven't testified before a committee before, just start by stating your name for the record and then just tell us your story.
Excellent. I'm Letitia Wilson. I'm the executive director at the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence. We serve survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault in Lynn and Benton counties and have been around for 33 years. So we definitely saw the inception of TADVS, have seen its benefits over the years, and have worked with many survivors. So we have a shelter program. We house people in our shelters with their families. So many times we have women with children in our shelter that are accessing this program from DHS, the TADVS program. And those are domestic violence survivors that I think would have greatly benefited from having the $1,200 gap increased to $2,000 as this bill suggests. I think, as mentioned previously, there is a housing crisis, but I think also affordable housing is what I would consider expensive. It's definitely not affordable, and with the $1,200 cap, it doesn't allow for any of those additional expenses that someone might have to be safe, because we are working with domestic violence survivors that do need safety from their abuser, safety within their home with their children. So I would definitely support increasing that. We also work with sexual assault survivors that wouldn't have been able to access this before this Senate bill. I'm going to give you one specific example of a woman that we worked with that had a minor child. She was assaulted by one of her neighbors. They obviously knew where she lived. She was no longer safe in her house. And all of a sudden, one day, she wasn't safe in her home. This didn't happen over time. It wasn't anything that she could have predicted. And I think, as we know, people don't have money in their savings account to be able to pay the deposit first and last month's rent. And expanding this to include sexual assault survivors that are assaulted by someone that's known to them, an acquaintance, neighbor, not a family member, would definitely be beneficial. I don't think it's, by and large, a large number of people that would be supported through this program, but it would be for people that really need the support that would be able to access it when they need it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, my name is Christina McGovney. I'm the shelter coordinator at Raphael House of Portland. Many survivors come through our emergency shelter program, have needed help from the TADVS program for crucial and at times life-saving assistance. One of the most important things for survivor when fleeing abuse with their children is a safe place to live. It has been mentioned that housing is incredibly challenging and competitive and not exactly affordable within Portland especially. And oftentimes survivors leave with nothing but what they can carry with their two hands. We often see in domestic violence that there are a high rate of economic abuse as well, which prevents survivors from being able to acquire savings. It also may impact their credit, rental, and criminal histories, making their barriers much higher. Some landlords will go out of the way to help out, but in taking that risk, they often require much larger deposits, ranging anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000. Many of the survivors we see use their entire TADVS grant to go towards this deposit, and oftentimes they have to come up with additional funds to make the complete deposit, as well as to cover moving costs and other things. With that, there are only 32 spaces for domestic violence shelter in Multnomah County, and we are often at capacity. So this happens that we see a lot of survivors that have to use some of that grant money to pay for a motel while they're trying to access shelter space, which ultimately leaves less money for them to be able to move into safe housing. I think increasing the cap on the program will provide greater flexibility to meet the emergency needs of our survivors in crisis and trying to establish safety for their children. It is incredibly challenging for survivors to focus on moving forward from abuse when they don't have their very most basic need met. On top of that, dealing with the trauma that they and their children have faced in abuse. We strongly believe that every person deserves a life free from violence, and the TADVS grant is a valuable tool in saving lives and helping victims truly become survivors. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I hope that you will support Senate Bill 503.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the executive director for the Center for Hope and Safety, formerly Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, serving Marion County. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon about a bill that I think can make such a difference in the lives of your constituents. I have been doing this work now for 24 years, and I was there in the beginning of TADVS. And I can tell you that I speak openly and publicly about, I don't know that there's been another piece of legislation that has saved more lives than TADVS over the years. I can think of hundreds of survivors that I have worked with that actually were able to flee a situation where probably they would have been in that very long list of individuals that lost their lives if it hadn't been for TADVS. So that's an amazing work that's already been done. This will allow us to help even more individuals. I would say that I have seen many survivors who are sexual assault survivors who could have benefited from this fund. Our staff has seen many others who would have been able to get out, get free of a place where someone knew where they were, be able to have some security measures. And I want to be really clear, TADVS, sometimes it is something as simple as a gas voucher to get someone from one place to another. Not everyone who comes in for TADVS uses all those funds. And so even though this is an increase that we're encouraging, it doesn't mean there's going to be every person is going to be accessing those $2,000. And so I think it's really important to keep that in mind as we look at this. And as you've heard, there are many individuals who absolutely could use an additional boost. $1,200 is wonderful, and they are so appreciative of that, and we are so appreciative of it. But you do have larger families that $1,200 makes it impossible for them to get into a safe place. And they are having to make difficult choices then about, do I leave? or do I stay because I'm not going to be able to have other funds to make up that gap? And so this is just one small way in which you would be able to make a huge difference for some of those survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence in the state of Oregon. And so I certainly encourage you to give it your full consideration and appreciate the opportunity to let you know what a difference that your support has made already and how much more it can make in the future. So thank you.
Thank you all so much, and thanks for taking the time to make the trip here. Are there questions for this panel?
I have one.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, ladies. I really appreciate, once again, your time put in. Question, though, when we increase this and it allows them greater flexibility, what happens after this money is gone? What do they do then?
This gives them
the start and puts them out there. But I've heard every one of you testify that, you know, there's financial circumstances that are not really that good. So what happens once they get out and get into maybe a new apartment or whatever? How do they continue on? Do we have resources to help them continue?
That's what we're able to help them with. So what we see most of the time is that when women are staying in our shelter, they're planning for that next step of where they're going to relocate. They're looking in that area to make sure that they're not moving too soon, that they won't be able to support themselves. So it's looking for a job, if that's how they're going to supplement their income, getting some of that other financial resources available for them so that this can be something that is supported. That's also something that the Department of Human Services, the caseworkers that Sybil mentioned, look at. They look at, is this just going to help for this 1 month that they're going to be able to be in this apartment, or is this something that they're going to be able to sustain over time? So it's something as advocates we're looking at. Is it going to be sustainable for them? As a survivor, they're looking at that, as well as the DHS caseworker.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? I just wanted to thank you all. The work that you do and that your organizations do is extraordinary. I know it's very difficult work for you and your employees and your volunteers that listen to these stories and support these women and these families, and then you have to go out and fundraise to keep the operations going. So thank you for it's not just a job, it's a passion, and I'm glad that you all chose this vocation. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, are you all okay if we set this for a work session on Tuesday? Can we do that? Excellent. All right. Was there anybody else that wanted to be heard on Senate Bill 503? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 503. Thank you all very much. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 591.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 591 expresses a state public policy to deny reinstatement with the Department of Human Services of employees terminated for violating mandatory reporting laws. It declares an emergency, is effective on passage.
Thank you. Ryan and Ken, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us today. My name is Ryan Vogt, and I am the Assistant Administrator for Field Operations for the Department of Human Services for Self-Sufficiency and Child Welfare Programs.
Senator Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Ken McGee, and I am a Senior Human Resources Manager for DHS.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to testify today. I've also provided written testimony for you. Really, just briefly, the reason why we're here today is, as you are aware, the Department of Human Services is tasked with the important responsibility of making sure the Oregon's most vulnerable citizens, children, seniors, and people with disabilities are protected from abuse and neglect. And we're responsible for investigating allegations of abuse and neglect. To that end, we believe that it is in the public's best interest that our employees be held to that high standard of making sure that they are responsible for complying with mandatory reporting laws. And so this piece of legislation just codifies into statute that that is an expectation of the members of the citizens of Oregon and of the legislative body, that it is important for DHS employees to be recognized as having to comply with that.
So I had a couple of quick questions just to put on the record, and I don't know if we need to clarify this in the text of the bill, but maybe we could start with how it works and then figure out what we need to do with the bill. But Would it be the intention of DHS with this bill that an individual is terminated for a failure to report abuse, and in the appeal process that that person would have a due process right to demonstrate that they actually did make that report, and somehow that report got lost in the process? Could that person then be reinstated once it was demonstrated that the report had been made?
Do you want to come in?
Yes. The answer would be yes to that. There is an appeal process that an employee goes through once there is an investigation that is completed. So they do have an appeal process through their local union, as well as beyond that.
And then I guess as a follow-up to that, how... So I had a conversation with someone today that raised a concern about an individual that believed that they had made a report because they had taken a child to the hospital, and while at the hospital filled out a police report. How well trained are individuals to know to whom they need to make that report to have that report be considered? And would DHS consider circumstances like that in a disciplinary process of whether the person in good faith thought they made the report, but they made the report to a police officer who then didn't maybe complete the cross-reporting to DHS?
So, Chair Gelser, thank you. We are actively working with SEIU and also with members of our organization. Mandatory reporter training is something that everybody who comes to Department of Human Services gets, and it is available to them more often than just when they come to the job. But we are working to revise the mandatory reporter training. There has been some internal adjustments related to adult abuse reporting already, and so we will continue working with our employees to make sure that they're clear about what the expectations are. And I'll let Ken answer the questions about how HR currently considers that type of a conversation.
So currently, in statute, there is actually... it's outlined on where a report needs to be made. That is either to local law enforcement, or it actually is to child welfare. So there is a CPS hotline that individuals may call or should call. If an individual believes that they made a report, we investigate where that report was made, how it was made, and to whom. We then look back at the circumstances that surround it, and we make a determination based on all the information that we gather. So it's the decision is not made in a vacuum. I guess I want to say that we thoroughly investigate all the information that's presented to us.
Okay. And then one other question that came up that I think goes, it's a question that comes up a lot about mandatory reporting, and this was specific to the adult population. Let's say that I am a mandatory reporter right now. I'm a legislator. I'm a mandatory reporter, and I have a friend named Beth who is a vulnerable elderly person. And I visit Beth, I meet her daughter, but I don't realize that there's something happening between the daughter and Beth, and later on it turns out there was financial fraud. Do I have a liability for having not reported that if I didn't know about it?
You do not.
So there's not a risk of going back and saying to an employee, you should have known about this, and therefore you should have reported this, and therefore you're terminated. It really is the investigation would have determined that the person had knowledge, should have had reasonable cause to believe, and should have made the phone call.
That is correct.
Thank you. Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So it seems as if, you know, part of the motivation behind this is that an employee was terminated for failure to report and then was reinstated by an arbitrator. What were the grounds that the arbitrator reinstated the employee under that this would circumvent?
So in this particular case, there are a couple of pieces of the statute that actually come into play. One is that a mandatory reporter is to report either to law enforcement or they're to report to child welfare. The second is the time frame, which is immediate. And immediate means without delay, so as soon as possible, now, I guess. And in this case, the individual ended up reporting, the arbitrator believed that the individual reported the following day, which is about 26 hours later. They believe the individual reported because the employee took the child to the hospital, where actually a physician actually reported it. So by statute, the individual, the employee did not actually report. The arbitrator believed that the individual did report, but it actually really missed on two points. One, that she reported, and the second point that was missed was the immediate time frame. So the arbitrator reinstated the employee based on saying that, or believing that she reported, but bypassed the piece about being late.
So if I could follow up on that, this legislation then would not impact that particular case, because in order to determine the inability to reinstate, the arbitrator would have to believe that that was the violation, that the individual hadn't complied with the law and had failed to make the mandatory report.
Well, the next piece is public policy. So in order to have an arbitrator's opinion or decision overturned, it has to be in the public policy, public opinion, public policy of the state that mandatory reporting, non-mandatory reporting is a violation of that. So, therefore, it would actually impact this, it would have impacted that case, because public opinion actually should state, based on the actual statute, that public policy was violated in this case.
So where then is the, and I like this bill, I drafted this bill, but where is the, I guess my intent and understanding of a good public policy would be, we want people who are mandatory reporters to report without delay, without exception, consistent with the law.
Correct.
And particularly at the Department of Human Services, violation of that is grounds for termination, and a person should not be reinstated if they have violated the law. But part of that to me is there has to be a due process to determine that the individual really did willingly, knowingly fail to report. So where in that description, where would this individual's ability to have an impartial review of, you know, kind of a reasonable person standard, would a reasonable person have believed that they were consistent with the statute? And was the issue this person, or was the issue confusion in the training? Because I hear time and again of people in all kinds of settings, school settings, I told the parent, I told the principal, but didn't call child welfare. We've worked really hard to retrain people in schools that, no, you have to personally make the telephone call.
Okay. Yes. And actually, the due process rights actually come in through the union. So there is due process through the union, through the grievance process, and there are actually three steps. There's the first step grievance, second step grievance, which actually comes back to the agency, and then the third step grievance, which actually goes to DAS, Labor Relations Unit.
Okay. Yes, so just following up on that, I mean, it seems as if the intent of this bill is to circumvent due process and progressive discipline. Presumably what's happening here is the violation would be deemed so egregious that it would go immediately to terminating the employee, and there would be no reinstatement rights if an arbitrator found that, well, in fact, that's too harsh a sentence for, you know, the circumstances of the case. Is that right? That's kind of how I'm reading it.
Well, I think that you can look at it in a couple of different ways. One would be that due process is occurring. It's occurring in the investigation, and then there's due process after that investigation for an employee to actually move forward with the union in pleading their case, if you will. The piece where it goes to an arbitrator would be for an arbitrator to decide whether the individual actually reported timely, or if they reported the incident in the correct manner. So that would be just, those would be the two places that we're actually looking to say, yes, we believe that an individual who does not mandatory report and circumvents or fails to report as outlined in the statute, it would be egregious based on the status that they hold with DHS as an employee.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you. Are there varying degrees of abuse that, I mean, some are very obvious, like a child has lumps and bumps, but are there other degrees of abuse that are not so obvious and a person would hesitate to make the decision that it is abuse? And would they, and in fact, if they did hesitate and it was abuse, would they be terminated because they weren't certain?
Yeah, I can answer that as well. But yeah, why don't you take that first, and then I think I'd like to add that as well.
Either one.
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, thank you. The statute as it reads now is reasonable cause to believe. And so the specifically your question is, are there different types of abuse? And some more obvious than others, the answer to that would be yes. In terms of the standard that the statute dictates would be the person's reasonable cause to believe that it has occurred. And so what that weight test would be in terms of how we explore that with an employee and a possible disciplinary action is what Ken and Human Resources would do in their investigation to try and figure out, does it meet the public policy of reasonable cause to believe? Did they do it timely? Did they do it to the right authority? And recognizing that I know this is kind of a complicated piece of legislation for something that seems so simple. I just want to remind that really this is also just about mandatory reporters for Department of Human Services, because we believe that the members of Department of Human Services, the public perception is that they should be held to a different standard, and that we have probably a more robust training expectation than would be across the board for all mandatory reporters.
Follow up. And I think it follows the line of on this particular employee that lost their job. Say the employee thinks that there might have been abuse. So he thought he did the right thing by taking the child to the doctor to determine if there was abuse. And the doctor determines that there was, so the doctor reports it, then this employee is in peril because it was abuse and he didn't report it. I find that to be a contradiction of the person's rights to be able to, you know, A or one, determine if it was abuse, and B or two, follow the correct procedure by taking to the doctor, and then all of a sudden the doctor says, yes, it is, and now the person's in jeopardy.
I think part of the issue, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the standard for mandatory reporting, the mandatory reporter, it's not their job to determine whether or not abuse occurred. The standard is reasonable cause to believe that abuse may occur or that there is imminent risk of harm. And then you call and the experts conduct the investigation. Nobody would want the mandatory reporter to make that investigation. In this case, if a person is concerned enough about a child that a child is just, I know nothing about this case now except for the child ended up in the hospital, that would suggest that there were probably some issues there that would cause a reasonable person to believe that there was abuse.
But then again, to cause a person a reasonable to believe that there was abuse, that's subjective. And then you get into the area of one person thinks it's not and one person thinks it is. And I'd like to see a more defined, maybe you guys can help me on this.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, my challenge is in the case that you're describing, and obviously I don't know all the facts, it seems as if discipline was appropriate, but permanent termination seems pretty extreme. And under this legislation, it seems as if the arbitrator would have no choice, if he or she found that there was a violation, would have no choice but to permanently terminate this employee. That seems extreme.
And I think I disagree with that, in that what my issue is making sure that there's due process to ensure that the person really violated the law. I do believe, as a matter of public policy, that the need to mandatory report, because you're talking about people who are so vulnerable is so significant, and it is the law of the state that a Department of Human Services employee breaking the law by willfully failing to report abuse when they suspect and they've hit that reasonable cause to believe, I do think that as a public policy should be grounds for termination. And we see that whenever there's an issue in the press around DHS and something that's happened with a child, we hear from our constituents, and many of us send out press releases that say, DHS, your workers should have done this. Why aren't you holding anybody accountable? Where I run into the issue is if a neutral third party arbiter looks at that and says, no, they didn't violate, they did, a reasonable person would have believed that they did comply with the law. They weren't intentionally trying to hide abuse or not get involved or...
Which is the process.
If I could just follow up. I mean, it seems to me that there's got to be a difference between somebody who willfully or, you know, really truly negligently acts in a way that you know, is going to result in the harm to the child. There should be an ability, I think, you know, for an arbitrator to be able to, you know, weigh the facts and say, yes, this is an extreme enough case that this person warrants permanent termination. This is a case where, you know, perhaps, you know, a period of time of suspension without pay or, you know, some pretty serious punishment could be given, but where the arbitrator's hands are not tied to, you know, given the facts of the case, perhaps this person should be allowed to be able to come back and have another chance.
There's the public policy debate. Yeah. What can you say what happened to the child in this case, ultimately?
The case was founded, and the child actually returned to parents later. I don't want to say an awful lot about the actual case itself, but in answer to Senator Olson's question regarding the severity of this, and I do believe that it was just in the termination, and reasons being that the mandatory reporter, the employee who did not actually mandatory report and who reported 27 hours later, was actually told by the child that this is what happened to me. So, and there were bruises. So there was evidence as well. So I do believe that we do have those cases where they are very clear-cut. This was a very clear-cut case. And the arbitrator went in an opposite direction. And so that's one of the reasons why we're here to ask for this legislation to be passed so that we have the opportunity once we have an employee who fails to meet those standards, fails to meet the public policy, fails to protect children as when they become a DHS employee, to uphold what our mission statement and goals are, that they are held responsible and held to a higher standard, which we all are. I am, Mr. Vogt is, and obviously all of you are as well. And so this is really a piece of legislation that will actually help the citizens of Oregon, help the children of Oregon, our most vulnerable citizens, and seniors and people with disabilities. So, just.
And I know we're going to bring Stacy and Tricia up, and I also know you all have been meeting to look on ways to, mm-hmm. to make the language appropriate. There are a lot of employees at DHS, and there is unfortunately a lot of abuse. How does a case like this come to the attention of human resources that somebody failed to make a report?
Well, there are several ways. Typically, we find these in when we have an open CPS assessment. So, And we find that an employee is involved somehow, whether they are in the periphery, family member, they happen to, you know, bring an issue up well after the fact, or someone brings their name into the incident. As we're going through our investigative process, when we find that an employee has been part of the investigation, we then take a look at their role. And so that's how we find these in most cases. Are there ones that we don't know about? Most certainly. There are cases that we just don't know that an employee has been involved, and that's unfortunate. But we do see, you know, between 1 and 5 mandatory reporting cases per year, unfortunately, that we do review and look at.
Manager?
Senator Olson?
In your process, if you determine that you feel through your investigations that an employee didn't report, what is their opportunity to talk to the issue and get their side of the story to you? Because right now it sounds like you're judge, jury, and executioner, and they really don't have a fair shake in the deal. Could you explain the process?
I most certainly can. So when we go through an investigative process, we first have what's called a fact-finding. And the fact-finding is when we just have some periphery information. So we'll actually bring the individual in and have a conversation with them about, you know, their whereabouts and what took place from their view.
Can I ask a question at this time? Since this could lead to the dismissal, would you Mirandize them or do anything to say that this could lead to your dismissal depending on the answers you give?
Actually, what we do is we allow a union steward who is their representation.
Okay.
And they have Weingarten rights.
Okay,
we'll certainly
thank you.
Do. Yeah, so we do talk to them during that session. If during that fact-finding meeting we find that there's information that we need to pursue further, we then pursue an investigation. If we then, at the end of that investigation, find that we need to take some sort of disciplinary action, we notify the union, we notify the employee of the action that we're taking, and we do that by written documentation. At that point, an individual employee has the opportunity to grieve the outcome, and they then grieve the outcome with the union back to the agency. These normally go to a step two because they're a little bit higher. They go through the agency. We re-review the information, any subsequent information that they provide. At the end of that, we render a decision on the first step grievance or the second step grievance. If we deny that grievance, it goes to DAS, Labor Relations Unit, who is separate from DHSHR, and they then go through their investigation process and render a decision at the third step grievance.
Okay, thank you.
There is due process.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both very much.
You're so welcome.
Yes, thank you.
All right, next we have Stacy and Tricia. Stacy is from SEIU and Tricia is from OSEA. But are you speaking for OSEA or are you?
Speaking for OSEA,
okay.
Of course.
Chair Gessler, members of the committee, Stacey Cowan with SEIU Local 503. We represent nearly 50,000 state workers, local government workers, statewide, including workers at DHS. I had testimony prepared. Given the nature of the conversation, I think I'll potentially deviate a little. And I will say that we signed in as neutral based on the direction of the conversation over the last several minutes. I think that we might have more concerns than I did leaving the conversation that we had with DHS this morning. I will say we have been in conversations with DHS. The conversation that we had, though, had a very different tone. So I think I'm not necessarily prepared to respond to all of the pieces that were talked about today. I have some concerns based on what was said. I had left that conversation feeling like the process wouldn't be touched. I'm a little concerned that this bill might impact folks pushing back and going through a process if they feel that they've been wrongfully terminated. When I went back to our folks to just talk a little bit about this bill and what the impact might be, that was the discussion that we had, was that there had been some instances where folks were wrongfully terminated. They went through the process. We just want to be certain that that process remains. I think the intent that you outlined for the legislation in the beginning, we're absolutely in support of. We just want to make sure that what's written down actually gets to that.
I'm a little concerned just based on the comments that were made around the particular case that brought this. It sounds like it was just one instance that brought this legislation forward. So I think we'd want to know a little bit more about sort of the facts around the case. It sounded like, based on the comments that were made earlier, that there was a disagreement with the arbitrator's decision. And so that feels a little bit different than how it was described to us today. So, you know, I apologize for bouncing around a little bit. Again, I had remarks prepared, and it didn't necessarily seem to fit the conversation. I did want to just touch on a few pieces. We absolutely appreciate the comments that were made about the need for additional training. As we started asking folks about mandatory reporting training, there was definitely an interest by staff to be able to have opportunities to participate in continued training as folks have been with agencies for a long amount of time. Also, as mandatory reporting is expanded to seniors, folks absolutely are interested in more training. So again, they know exactly the right process to follow and exactly the right definitions to follow. And, you know, the bottom line is the conversations that I had with workers is that folks want to do the right thing. They just want to know how to do it and how and they want the tools to be able to do the right thing. So I think with that, I'll go ahead and my comments.
And would you be willing to get back together with the group again and then maybe Senator Olson and I sometime in the next couple weeks to kind of further continue the conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate that. And I, you know, again, it, I think that that would be of great value.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I am here with no position on this bill and did not intend to speak until I heard some of the discussion. And the reason that I am speaking is because my members are mandatory reporters in schools, and when the legislature passes policy regarding mandatory reporting, they like that policy to be pretty close to the same across the spectrum of reporters so that we don't have different ways of doing things for different people. And the thing that caused me to request that I be allowed to speak was the statement from one of the previous speakers that this bill establishes a public policy that is greater than the current reporting requirements. And I didn't really understand the discussion after that about in what way and how it makes it different, but it concerns me that it does make it different, and how that difference would ultimately affect my members also is concerning until y'all work this out, what this actually means and what it actually does. When I first read it, I didn't even track it. But I do believe that these things tend to spread out. And so I hope that you will dig deeper into this and figure out what the bill actually does before you move it.
And I think when I heard that and from conversations before, and I'm not speaking for, I'm just expressing my understanding, I think the difference between the employees at DHS and the employees that are represented by OSEA would be that DHS is the agency that's responsible for carrying out the investigations and receiving the abuse requirements, and therefore the training there theoretically should be better, and all of the employees should be at the highest standard of understanding. So that's what I had understood. I could be, they're nodding their heads there.
Madam Chair, I could understand that, although I assume the people who investigate reports of abuse are different than the people who are caring for children. And the people that are caring for children at DHS are similar to the people who are caring for children in schools. And so I assume the investigators know more than my folks do. That's why we report if we suspect rather than no, but this bill doesn't seem to delineate.
Thank you, Senator.
Deborah.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, I'm Sarah.
Still new to the Senate.
No. Thank you, Representative. So. You know, my concern with this, as I mentioned before, is the way that it, you know, as I see it, ties the hand of an arbitrator. You know, remember, in the arbitration process, you know, and I have some familiarity with the grievance arbitration process, you know, the arbitrator is chosen by both sides and presumably is someone that is deemed, you know, capable by both sides. And I would expect that an arbitrator, you know, might or probably would consider the DHS employee to be subject to a higher standard. But, you know, to say that reinstatement is not possible under any circumstances, you know, I think is a kind of, I don't know, it ties the hands of the judge in a way that I think is, you know, we don't want to do that. You know, the different cases are going to have different facts. And again, I don't know what the case, you know, what exactly happened here. I can certainly imagine cases that are egregious, you know, to the point that you would never want to reinstate that person. But I can also, you know, imagine some cases in which it's just not, you know, it's certainly not willful. It's not something that is worthy of that degree of, you know, permanent termination. So, you know, I mean, I realize this sends a message, but I think it has the negative effect. Potential negative effects are concerning.
Senator Cruz, you look like you're about to.
I can make some assumptions here. Those of us that are mandatory reporters sometimes question the marginal things. Should we be or should we not be? Like you see something in a supermarket or something like that. I guess I would assume that if DHS is going full meal deal on these people, there's something incredibly significant that actually would be more of a cover-up than just failure to report sort of thing. So I would imagine the process would determine the severity, and the severity would determine the process to a degree.
Correct.
So it would be, you know, maybe the two of you need to explore this a little bit more.
So we will certainly be having more conversations about this and trying to find that balance between good policy that keeps kids safe and protecting people's employment rights and common sense. And so I appreciate the department. And I want to thank the department in the original form of the bill. This is actually an agency bill that was introduced, and it just covered kids. But we've expanded all of our mandatory reporting to seniors as well. And so this is just redrafted to include the entire mandatory reporting population.
Could you put an amendment in there that at the beginning of session for the mandatory reporting training, if we've already been through it for two decades, that we could skip one?
This year's was so interesting. All right. Thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 591. We're still out early. 6 minutes.
Cool.
We haven't run late yet. Thank you all very much. We're adjourned.